ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Vivian Kelly.
And I'm Tim Burrows.
It's been a blizzard of cuts this week.
Yeah, with three major TV shows being sent to the farm.
We'll be getting stuck into the changing TV landscape in just a moment. But first, Australian reporters have been in the firing line. There was a shocking moment on Nine on Tuesday this week involving the network's US correspondent, Lauren Tomasi.
After hours of standing off, this situation has now rapidly deteriorated. The LAPD moving in on horseback, firing rubber bullets at protesters, moving them on through the heart of LA.
You just shut the f*** up!
You okay?
That's a hard listen, Viv, and an even harder watch, especially as you see the officer fire towards the camera to hit her.
Yeah, so Lauren was at the LA protests or riots, depending on how you frame it, and she was simply reporting to camera. And if you watch the footage, you can see an officer turn and point the gun towards her and shoot her with what they now seem to be calling less lethal bullets. I think because the term non-lethal has proven to be incorrect in the past. So being shot with something less lethal than, I presume, a normal bullet, but it's still very confronting.
Yeah, and the terminology has been, yeah, one of those things which has been a bit confused. I've heard rubber bullets, I've heard sponge bullets, which definitely doesn't do it justice. My first thought as soon as I saw that clip, though, was why is a reporter for Nine, a big organisation, out in what's clearly a dangerous situation in jeans and a shirt? You know, why no protective clothing?
I think it's important to make the distinction here that you're in no way blaming Lauren for the fact that an officer went rogue and shot
Absolutely
at her.
Not.
But I guess you're looking to the responsibility of the media organisation, given it is effectively, well, it is her workplace, and should they have provided more protective gear? We did put that question specifically to Nine, and in their statement to us, they didn't address the whether she should have been wearing more or whether that was their policy.
Yeah, they've been avoiding that question all week with Umbrella, which is the other job I do. We asked the same question and had a similar kind of non-answer to it, because you would think that any organisation has, well, you know that organisations have policies about the safety of staff in those situations. And I personally was really shocked that they hadn't done more to set up their crews with appropriate safety, particularly when you see, certainly as the week has developed, other staff wearing Kevlar.
Well, other staff from various media organisations from Australia have now been injured by police actions in these protests and riots. And I think my gripe with Nine is more the language they used in reporting on their own incident. They talked about Lauren being caught in the crossfire, and even in the statement they issued to Mumbrella, it was about Lauren Tomasi being injured while covering protests in the United States. It's quite passive language, considering if you look at the visual of the audio we played before, you can see with your own eyes an officer turn and shoot her for no reason. And Nine is sort of saying, you know, we need to find out what led to this. They're looking for the how and the why and the justification with this formal investigation. They said it is important to find out what happened and why, as if there's any justification for shooting a journalist who's covering a protest.
And I wonder if at least some of it is sensitivities around the fact that as a journalist covering another country, you're reliant on the authorities for your visa and all of those things. You know, is there some sort of fear of angering the authorities and falling out with them, I wonder?
If the media becomes scared of angering the authorities, then honestly, we should all just pack up now, don't you think? I mean, what's their role if they're just going to capitulate?
That's exactly the worry. I do not understand why Nine has not been angrier about this.
Well, it's never good news when journalists are being shot by things other than the cameras. SBS is making a lot of noise this week, Tim, celebrating a milestone birthday.
Yes, and whether we can actually call it the 50th birthday is neither here nor there. What happened was in 1975, two radio stations, 2EA and 3EA, kicked off broadcasting in 15 languages between them.
Here's Al Grusby presenting the first ever broadcast on 2EA in 1975.
This is Al Grusby on behalf of the Australian Community Relations Office, welcoming you all to Radio 2EA, the voice of ethnic Australia.
Well, Viv, he's about to switch into another language for the first broadcast there from English. We'll have a guess if you're listening on what language that was, and we'll tell you more at the end of the show.
I'm glad you were asking the listeners to guess, not me, because I know the answer and I was quickly trying to scramble to think of a different language to pretend I didn't know the result.
No, it's got to be all about authenticity on this show, Viv. I suppose language is a good place to start. Multi-language broadcasting, it's become, I suppose, easier now to communicate in any language. How do you see its place going forward?
Well, I am conscious that we are two white people who speak English talking about a multi-language broadcaster and its place in our communities and society. So it's not a broadcaster that exists for me, for my pleasure or for my needs, but I think it absolutely does have a role. It might be easier for people who have migrated here from all over the world to communicate with people in other countries or find communities here via social media that they connect with. But when they turn on the television, if there's nothing for them, if there's nothing in their language, if there's nothing about their communities and their culture, they're going to feel more disconnected than the rest of us. So the fact that they can switch on and maybe see a news program from home or a movie in the language that's theirs or a documentary on an area that they may have fled from, that will always have a place.
And I suppose the other thing about SBS is it also has this dual role where it does occasionally need to try and attract big audiences because about a third of its revenue comes from advertising. So it needs to do that. So we see things like the World Cup, for instance, come along where the big audiences tune in and then it makes a little bit more money through advertising for that time. So there are times where, you know, SBS would say it's for all of Australia.
Yeah, and I think the World Cup, though, isn't just about the revenue potential. You know, that is the biggest sport in the world. Ethnic groups from all different areas are obsessed with that game. So whilst there is an upside that there is revenue, that revenue is there because the audiences are there, because the communities are there, and because the cultures are there. So I think SBS does have a really difficult challenge because if it only chases ratings and revenue, it could risk skewing its purpose. You know, they have a remit to cater to these different language groups and these different ethnic groups and these different cultures. If they only want to be everything to everyone, that's not quite possible. For some of the smaller language groups, they're not going to get millions of viewers, are they? Because we don't have millions of people who need that program, but the ones who need it really need it. So it's that tension that comes with public broadcasters about do they want ratings or do they want to serve their purpose? But SBS is not the only network with a challenge in front of it. It has been a rough week for TV media all round, public and commercial.
You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly. This week, Network 10 announced that the project will cease broadcasting at the end of this month, as the show itself had a bit of fun with announcing.
Great to have you here. We begin tonight, of course. Sorry, we begin tonight with some big news.
Yes, about we do. The show. Fantastic. Uh-oh. Hey!
What's that for?
I think I got the tone wrong. Was that... Oh, it's not. All right. Okay. Well, what am I going to do with this one? cost me $19.
You really missed that meeting. That was a shame. No, we are here to announce. Are you right there?
I'm all right.
Typical project style.
They should take us off air.
After 16 years and what, nearly 4,500 episodes, the project will very soon be no more.
I think that clip there perfectly encapsulates what the project has both been criticised and praised for, that balance between news and comedy, but they did get there in the end with the announcement.
They did get there in the end, and then the ABC got there the next day announcing the end of its long-running political panel show, Q&A.
Foxtel were in on it as well, letting viewers know this week that Australia's longest-running sports show, The Back Page, is calling it quits.
So what's going on in television at the moment? Sydney Morning Herald and The Age national TV editor Louise Rugendyke joins us now.
Hello, team.
Louise, in 2025, were the project and Q&A still fit for purpose, or had their moment gone, do you think?
I feel like their moment had passed a little bit. Like, they still provided, you know, the service of, well, for the project, they still did news differently. Q&A still provided the public with a platform with which to question politicians and other people. But the audiences just weren't following at the moment. Q&A's ratings had dropped quite a bit from their heyday, sort of around 2015. And the project, you know, its ratings probably weren't startling, and, you know, it's maybe just its balance of news and comedy maybe just wasn't quite sitting well with audiences as it once had, I would say.
And do you think some of it, or at least some of it, is just simply because audience patterns have changed rather than being about the shows itself?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Because, I mean, look, you think back when the project was launched, it was very much launched for a youth audience. The hosts at the time were Dave Hughes, Charlie Pickering and Carrie Bickmore, and they were all aged in their late 20s, early 30s, and that was the audience that 10 was then going for. And that's fine, and that's pretty much when everyone was sitting down and watching a new show like that. We weren't as distracted by our smartphones and social media. We're quite happy to sit and have the news and bit of comedy fed to us. But, you know, 16 years on, that audience has grown and they're probably still a little bit happy to sit there and watch the project, but there's no new audience coming through, which is the problem, because that new audience is watching, you know, is getting most of their news, from, you know, social media like TikTok and Instagram and Facebook, or maybe not Facebook, certainly TikTok. And they're not interested in broadcast news as, you know, that age group kind of used to be. So I suppose the project was no longer relevant. They were no longer serving the younger audience that they were made for. They were now serving sort of an older audience that maybe weren't there in droves as they once was, I suppose.
Louise, that point about social media is an interesting one, though, because whilst you frame it that in 2025 we're getting distracted by social media, I feel like when both the project and Q&A launched, we weren't distracted by social media because they were so integral and integrated into those programs. Mm. They would have tweets coming up on the screen. They had hashtags that would be trending. Do you think the demise of Twitter has sort of had an impact on these programs?
Oh, completely. Like Q&A, it used to be so much fun to try and get your tweet on screen. Like, it was almost like this national sport that everyone was sitting around like madly tweeting, trying to get some pithy comment going on TV. But I think that was when, yeah, Twitter was a fun environment where you could make jokes and, you know, have a little bit of a go at people without it turning into some, I don't know, toxic. Twitter is a sewer now. I think it's been described that this week, that Twitter turned into a sewer. The comments then, it became a dangerous place, not just for the viewers watching the show who could get their opinions attacked, but also the hosts. Like Hamish McDonald said, you know, he left, one of the reasons that he left hosting Q&A was because the vitriol became too much from Twitter, and Stan Grant too. Left as well because he and his family were subjected to vile abuse over social media and Twitter by people, you know, tweeting in during the show and things like that. And that's not acceptable at all. And, you know, so so Twitter never stopped being a safe place, I think, to happily communicate with politicians and with the journalists who were on the show. And it stopped being fun. I mean, and once it stops being fun, it takes away a large part of the reason to watch it because, you know, the Q&A at its height was fun to watch and you learned something, much like the project. And once they are not serving that audience or serving that remit, then it's not really, they're not working anymore, I suppose.
And I suppose it was so integral to Q&A, the innovation that came at the time of integrating Twitter so much, you know, because I remember they had to kind of create, you know, special kind of bits of technology themselves just to manage that, something like 18,000 tweets an hour over the hashtag. And obviously they had to move away from that. But I suppose one of my questions is, what was the next piece of innovation? You know, was that almost the problem for the show, that it didn't really innovate in a different direction?
I don't know. It's hard to say because, I mean, broadcast current affairs and broadcast news, I mean, I don't know how you want them to innovate because you want people to sit and watch the screen. Like if you sort of start turning it around to TikTok, then you're taking people away from the screen that you want them to watch. So I don't know. I think it just became how politics became a really divisive issue. Social media became extremely divisive in the last few years. And as I said, it became a dangerous place. And, you know, that stops making shows interesting for viewers to watch. And it makes other, like politicians and things like that, it makes them probably not want to go on shows like Q&A because they can't say anything anymore. Like Malcolm Turnbull, you know, almost like, that Q&A almost handed him the prime ministership. I don't want to sound flippant about that, but Malcolm Turnbull on Q&A created this very cool persona, Mr. Leather Jacket, and everyone fell in love with Malcolm Turnbull if they watched Q&A. And that kind of smoothed his path to the prime ministership a little bit. I don't want to sort of make too big a deal of it, but it allowed politicians to show their personalities. And as social media became, you know, as I said, more toxic, and it became more and more difficult to probably be your real self on television, then it became less interesting to watch. And politicians and anyone else on there were either just saying the same thing, sticking to their speaking notes. And if someone did speak out, then they were sort of shouted down and abused. And why would anyone want to go on a show like that? And why would anyone want to watch it either?
Louise, I think that's probably the first time in Australian history that someone has said the phrase, everyone fell in love with Malcolm Turnbull.
You know what I mean? Like, even if you didn't vote Liberal, you're kind of like, oh, he seems like an okay guy.
You're listening to Medialand on Radio National. TV writer Louise Rugendyke is our guest. Louise, what did you make of the wider announcements out of the ABC about the kind of reorganisation which accompanied the end of Q&A?
Yeah, I mean, job cuts are always a terrible thing to hear about. And unfortunately, the media, including my organisation, like we went through a large round of redundancies last year, just always a horrible thing to hear about. The announcements that they're now going to focus on high-end programs and documentaries wasn't a great surprise, because if you had been paying any attention to what the ABC chair, Kim Williams, has been saying ever since he stepped into the job, it's been just that he wanted to focus on documentaries and high-end programming, and he wanted to make, I think he called it, he wanted to make the ABC the national campfire where people could gather and express their opinions. And so pretty much these new programs that have been announced by the ABC are very much in line with what Kim Williams has said over the last year. You know, and one of them is called the Your Say Project, which they sort of rolled out during the election. And that's pretty much, as far as I can work out, it's like fancy vox pops, and it's getting the audience to ring in and say, you know, write in and say what they're concerned about, and then the ABC will cover that. So in a way, it's fantastic. They want to cover a broad audience, because that's what the ABC should do. They should represent all of Australia, and by allowing people from the regions and country areas to help, you know, shape their programming, that's a great thing. But if it comes at a cost of sort of, you know, other current affairs shows, it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Louise, the ABC and the commercial networks have a real challenge in front of them, trying to find this elusive youth market, which the project tapped into really well in its heyday. Does anyone know where that audience is now? Or if they know where they are, do they know how to shepherd them back to where they want them?
They're on TikTok, Viv.
Yeah, I think that's it. They're not watching television. It's And the younger audience, even like my daughter, she's 8 years old. Look, she watches News Breakfast because of her parents, basically. So she's very aware of what's going on in the world. But I also, I have, you know, friends, adult friends of mine my age who don't watch any news also, and they don't know what's going on. So I don't know how you catch the market. And I kind of think it's really interesting what Ten have announced with their new investigative news show, which is going to replace The Project. It's called Ten News First, I think. They're going for more longer, in-depth stories. So I think it feels like they've decided, you know what, I'm not going to worry about the youth audience. We're going to capture the people who actually care about news. And I think by trying to find niche programming for that niche audience is where the future is at. It's like, I think the broad generalist news programming maybe is not what's going to work anymore. You've got to try and find the audience and target the audience where they are. So, you know, this 10
yeah,
News
it's
First Plus.
10 News Plus is the new program that they've announced.
Which sounds like a great medication.
Great medication will, you know, cure your ails and things like that. So I think they're looking for people who are interested in news because it was interesting, all the comments under the stories I wrote this week about the end of Q&A and The Project, people are all bemoaning. And look, I also admit our audience too is a little bit older. They're all bemoaning the fact that there's no serious news anymore and, you know, bring back the drum and all that kind of stuff. So if this is what, you know, the 10 are going to do and they're going to be successful with a more serious program, there does seem to be an audience who want it. If they will tune in, that's another matter. Hopefully they will, because it's, you don't really want to see the end of programs and the end of local programming at all. You know, it's good to have our own voices out there.
I think there has been always some evidence that when you ask people what they want, they take a very high-minded answer, but then their behaviour can be different. I do agree with you, Louise, that maybe one of the things going on there with Ten's move is they're recognising that having been the most youth-focused network, that audience has gone away, so they have to think again. So it seems to be a sign of that. Do you see any signs, though, that there is any kind of appetite for news in younger audiences?
I think there is. Mainly, look, this, and again, it's another weird example, but I think The Cheap Seats, also on 10, is pitched at a younger audience, but a broad audience watches it. And they are a comedy program, but it's hosted by two people in their 30s, and it's really successful. They're talking about news, they're making fun of news, but you could also pretty much, you know, get a pretty good idea of what's going on around the place just by watching the show. So I think comedy is still the answer of kind of, you know, and then sort of wedging a bit of news in there.
I'm always a big fan of a show that involves a presenter called Tim being bullied by his female co-host.
I can do more of that if that's what will make us successful, Tim.
That's what I was thinking about the other day watching that show too, is it's like one of the actual few shows on Australian television where the male is in the minority. It's when Mel Tresina's on there. This is two women versus one man. And usually all those panel shows are majority men, one lady. So I'm always very happy to see the women taking the lead on those shows. So, yeah, so I think comedy is the way in, and Ten could be, you know, using their new show as a bit of a Trojan horse, sort of get the, you know, serious news in, and then the younger audience there who are watching maybe MasterChef, Survivor, all their sort of fun reality stuff, maybe they will stick around and see a bit of news while they're there. Who knows? I don't know. It's a tricky one. I don't know.
Louise, let's try and find a positive somewhere. The ABC says that as part of their announcement, they are going to invest in political documentaries, so new content, particularly around documentary. Something exciting there?
Yes. Look, ABC does fantastic political documentaries. Was it the Killing Season, the one on Labor? Was amazing.
The marvellous Four Corners series.
Yeah. And look, their nature documentaries, their recent one on the Kimberley was, you know, breathtaking. It was beautifully, beautifully done. I just don't know how much of an audience there is for it. The ABC audience probably loves a good documentary. I think they also probably enjoy a good Australian drama. There's not many of those on free-to-air at the moment. So if I was going to be putting my money anywhere, it would probably be in free-to-air drama and comedy, because they are dwindling fast.
We will put those on the to-do list. Thank you, Louise, for joining us on Medialand.
No worries.
So we've heard a lot this week, Tim, about programs disappearing from our screens. Let's try something more positive. What have you been watching that is still around?
Well, as you know, Viv, as I sit here talking to a studio in Sydney, whilst in fact living in Tasmania, I spend a lot of time on planes. So my little treat whenever I'm on one is I will watch on Stan an episode of Fargo, which we're now up to season 5. Although I recently had something of a stumble when I got to the penultimate episode of season 4 and then somehow jumped forward by a whole season and was completely baffled by the fact that I didn't recognise any of the characters or the scene. But because it's quite a curious style anyway, so the showrunner is Noah Hawley, but he follows the style of the Coen brothers, and it's this quite sort of quirky kind of Minnesota folk. I went a whole episode thinking that none of this makes sense. But yes, if you want to see Jon Hamm from Mad Men as a really good baddie, then I strongly recommend Fargo.
Well, I'm trying to reduce my screen time at the moment, so I have been reading instead of streaming, also because I keep watching such anxiety-inducing shows. So I thought I'll put the laptop away and I'll read. Picked up a book by Holly Wainwright, who is one of the executive editors at Mamma Mia.
And you told us that you've lost sleep reading this book because you've been staying up late to read
it. I have. So Holly, if you're listening, I turned to your book to reduce the anxiety and it did not happen. It's such a good book. It's called He Would Never. Definitely read it, but one of the characters is so thoroughly unlikable and anxiety-inducing, and he's supposed to be, that it was not the stress-free reprieve I was looking for, but it's a great Australian novel, really paints a picture of those family dynamics with long-standing friends going on a traditional camping trip away and the things that can go wrong when everybody's sort of keeping secrets from each other.
A health warning and a recommendation.
That's what I like to do. Remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app.
And tell us, what's your favourite TV show that's been cancelled? We'd love to hear from you. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
For those playing along with the first 2EA broadcast from 1975, here's your answer.
Today, the programme is in Greek.
Sas Mila o Algrasbi. Σας καλωσορίζει στο ραδιοφωνικό σταθμό 2EA, Αυστραλία, που είναι η φωνή της πολυεθνικής Αυστραλίας.
So it was Greek. Thanks to our producer, Rob Kelly, who I somehow need to clarify is no relation.
We will catch you the same time next week in your feeds and on Radio National.
See you, Tim.
Toodle pip, Viv.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.